This is the first day of this August 2000 two-day session. And I'm going to read from an article that appeared in a Buddhist periodical called Inquiring Mind. It's a periodical of Vipassana Buddhism. There are three main streams of Buddhism that have taken root in the West. There's Zen, and then there's Vajrayana, commonly known as Tibetan Buddhism, and then there's Vipassana, which comes from Southeast Asian Buddhism. And in this periodical from 1989, Inquiring Mind, there's an article here about commitment by Susan Moon. Susan Moon is the editor of the Journal of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. It's called Turning Wheel. I don't know if she was at that time in 1989. But anyway, this article is called Thinking About Commitment. And Susan is not a teacher, I don't believe. She was at this recent conference of Buddhist teachers that I attended this summer, but I don't think she was there as a teacher. She was there as the editor of Turning Wheel. But nonetheless, I think it's a very insightful article and very well written, and it will give me different points to comment on. She begins, "Commitment is not a particularly Buddhist concept, but it is certainly a concept which bears on Buddhist practice. When I hear the word commitment, I think first of the context of intimate relationships, marriage being the most obvious example. But of course we can speak also of commitment to work, or to a spiritual practice, among other things. We're familiar with Freud's definition of mental health as the ability to love and to work, and I would add to that a third sphere of human endeavor, and that would be the ability to have some kind of life of the spirit. In all three of these areas, that is, love, work, and spiritual practice, I believe that the concept of commitment has relevance, well, more than relevance. It is central. Commitment is central to love, it is central to work, and it is central to spiritual practice, which really embraces both love and work. And then she asks rhetorically, what do we actually mean by commitment? I like the word wholeheartedness, which is perhaps a more Buddhist way to think about the same thing. The word commitment implies engagement with an activity over a long period of time. Wholeheartedness implies a depth of engagement at a given moment in time. Maybe we could say that commitment is a horizontal kind of engagement, and wholeheartedness is a vertical kind of engagement. I think it's a useful distinction. I think wholeheartedness is a good word, but I would stick with commitment. Probably the classic fundamental commitment in Buddhism is committing oneself to come to awakening for the sake of all sentient beings. No matter how long it takes. That's the longevity aspect, the long aspect of commitment that she refers to. That commitment, we could say, really it means whatever it takes. Whatever it takes. When we get married, we commit to seeing it through whatever it takes. And, well, the fact is that sometimes, quite often actually, one's karmic affinity with one's spouse changes, and which doesn't mean it goes away. The fact that one separates or gets divorced doesn't mean that the karma is exhausted between those two people. Sometimes it just inverts itself. It goes from love to hate, but that doesn't mean the karma is exhausted. But it can also, I think, in some cases, really be exhausted when the partners part on an amicable basis. But when we make the commitment in the marriage vows, it is for good. It is, you know, till death do us part in the Western vows. And something very powerful comes from that. Well, she touches on this more later. I'll leave that till then. But there is immense power in commitment. So much issues forth from it. Because in any serious endeavor, whether it's marriage or a job or the mastery of a skill or spiritual practice, we're going to run into hindrances, problems, difficulties, dry periods, confusion, doubt. And it is commitment that can help us persevere in the face of those obstacles. And she asks, "Am I committed to Buddhist practice? I started sitting at the Berkeley Zen Center 13 years ago. I have often been uncertain, wondered whether it was right for me, been beset by doubts. Somewhat unaccountably, after 8 years of practice, I felt ready to have what we call lay ordination, that is, to take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, take the 10 precepts, the 4 vows, and receive a Buddhist name." That's what we would call Jukai, taking the precepts. We have the Jukai ceremony twice a year, the big one, the major Jukai ceremonies in the fall. She says, "It was a subtle and unconscious transition for me, like finding oneself hungry and sitting down to a bowl of cold cereal. No big deal. No big decision. It didn't mean that I would do anything any differently from before. I was not becoming a priest. I would look just the same. But it was a way for me to make a statement to myself and to my community that I am committed. It was a way to let go of doubt, to make some room for wholeheartedness and faith. I felt different afterwards. I now say to myself and to anybody who asks me that I'm a Buddhist. Looking back, I have to conclude as a historian that yes, I must be committed to Buddhist practice just because I am still doing it. But can one be retroactively committed? This sounds like an easy way out. Can one even be committed to something without knowing it consciously?" Well, it's a good question, and we don't have to answer it, just as she didn't answer it. We can always be wise in hindsight. Those of us who've been sitting many years, we can, by looking back at our at our history with Zen practice or Buddhist practice, we can, yes, we can conclude that I must have a deep affinity for the Buddha Dharma. But looking ahead, we never know. We never know how much further that affinity will go on. But by committing ourselves in any number of ways, we are more likely to extend that affinity. Maybe just a little more likely, because affinity is such a profound, profound, mysterious thing. Especially when we take vows publicly, the way she did in taking the precepts, well, then we're maybe a little less likely to bail out when the going gets tough. Just as in marriage, that public vow before our family and friends and sangha, that may have kept many people through the trying times of marriage. And that's why it's done. I remember in my early years of practice, I gave a lot of thought to becoming ordained as a celibate monk. At that time, Roshi had ordained a couple of people here, three actually, as celibate monks, and I was living a celibate life and was very drawn to take vows. And I remember struggling with it and asking one of the guys who had been ordained as a celibate monk, and I said, I want to, but I don't know for sure, for absolute sure, if it's my karma to be a celibate monk the rest of my life. And what he said, I'll never forget, he said, "You make it your karma." It's the vow, it's the commitment in the form of a vow that shapes our karma. In the case of a partner, a life partner, we have the trust and the faith and the love for someone that we're willing to make this commitment and do whatever it takes to stay with that person. In the case of spiritual practice, we have to have the faith to make such a commitment. But if we do have the faith in it, then by making the commitment, we yoke ourselves to this great ancient tradition that has brought so many, many countless women and men to spiritual liberation. Again, realistically, we can see that it often isn't enough to make the commitment. That we find, as time goes on, that because we change, or our understanding of Buddhist practice and teaching changes, that we lose interest, we go somewhere else. So it's not... Uh, it's not sufficient to make the commitment, but for a real viable practice, it is necessary in some way, even if it isn't formally, publicly, a commitment to take the four vows has great significance. This is why we do it several times a day. In taking the four vows, we're really saying that I'm going to stick with this whatever it takes. And that vow, each time we make it sincerely, especially if we make this vow with the mind relatively empty and not cluttered with daydreams and random thoughts, but if we do it wholeheartedly, then each time we do it, it goes a little deeper. And the force, the momentum of having done the four vows repeatedly, maybe hundreds or thousands of times, carries through on into the future. And I'm convinced it also carries through into our next lifetime. And that's the time frame that is the most intelligent way of approaching practice, is not seeing it as just something of this lifetime, but something that however many lifetimes it takes, I'm going to make my best effort. And that's what it really means. It doesn't mean when we commit ourselves to practice, it doesn't mean that we're signing up to do it perfectly. No one does it perfectly. No one. We're all just doing our best with this, with all of this habit energies of random thoughts and afflictive emotions, greed, anger, delusion. We're all struggling to one degree or another. And that's the commitment to maintain the struggle, to persevere in the face of the difficulties. She goes on, I know from painful experience that in personal relationships, you can't make yourself be wholehearted. I've tried. And then she poses this kind of train of thought of her own. She says, what a terrific guy. He's single, straight, and considerate. I should fall in love with him. And then she says, it doesn't work. You can't make yourself feel certain things, no matter how much you want to feel them. But if you can't just decide to be wholehearted, can you just decide to be committed? Yes, you can. But, this is me talking now, but if the purest, or I should say maybe the rightest, the truest decision is beyond deciding. It's not I'm making the decision. Rather that the decision unfolds from one's basic nature. That's the ideal, of course. That's what we would want in any commitment, is that it commits us. Not that there is an I who's weighing the variables and coming up with a decision, a conscious decision. Maybe that happens too often. Maybe that is a problem in marriage, where one sizes up one's partner and maybe even does a little calculation about future income and all kinds of things, and then decides to make a commitment. But what is that? But she goes on, Perhaps if you make a commitment, the wholeheartedness will come after, in the space you've safeguarded with the commitment, like a plant in a fenced garden, like an arranged marriage. Or must both commitment and wholeheartedness grow without being pushed, unnoticed, organically, like mushrooms in the dark? That last question, do they both have to grow unpushed, unnoticed? Well, you can't say either way. Either way is not the whole picture. It's either way is missing the whole. We make an effort, and from that effort, commitment unfolds. Wholeheartedness grows. And as it does, the effort comes from a clearer place in us, which itself then is the effect of genuine commitment growing. Those many years ago when this monk said to me, "You make it your karma," I thought of arranged marriages, because that's what you do with an arranged marriage. You take it out of the realm of choice, which always includes a smaller or greater degree of ego preferences. You take it out of that realm, and you make a commitment to a person, and you just grow into it. Because if you don't, you're going to be miserable. We should never forget that hundreds of millions of people in this world, hundreds of millions of marriages in this world, are arranged marriages. I think that in China and India alone, most marriages are still arranged marriages. That's probably about half of the world's population, maybe more than half. We may be in the minority. We probably are. Our cultural tradition of choosing one's partner. So how does the rest of the world do it? Before we dismiss arranged marriages as being ridiculous, old, archaic things, well, it works in its own way. Certainly, you could say it works as well as in this country, where you have some 50% of marriages ending in divorce. You make it work. And from what I've often heard, or read rather, about arranged marriages, just by being with the partner year after year after year after year, love grows. Some kind of love, anyway. There's so many different kinds of love, but enough that often something wonderful emerges, even though one may not have chosen that person originally. It's the same with practice. If it resonates, if the Dharma resonates with us, then we can make this resolve that will... The resolve gets us to practice. And when we practice on a daily basis over a long period of time, It will work. There's no question but that it'll work. The reason that people quit practice is because they quit. I mean, they quit practice. No, the other way around. It doesn't work because one quits practice. If you stick with it, if you can manage to stick with practice, daily practice, then it'll work. It's been tested over centuries and centuries. She talked in the beginning about these three spheres of human endeavor: love, work, and spirituality. You could say that all three deal with intimacy. And in all three, if you're not wholehearted, then you're going to be pretty miserable. We find this out especially in Sesshin. By coming to Sesshin, by signing that Sesshin application at the bottom in which we promise to, if accepted, to complete the Sesshin, by putting our signature on that form, we're making a commitment. And what we find sooner or later is that if we are separated from our practice, if we indulge in random thoughts and fantasies and daydreams, then we're going to be miserable. And conversely, the more wholeheartedly we can get into this simple absorption in the practice, the breath or the koan, the less painful it is. Separation, though, is always painful. Separation from one's partner, one's spouse, separation from work, separation from zazen, from sesshin. I remember it took a while for me to really understand this word separation. I remember it was kind of abstract to me until I'd gone to, well, I don't remember, at least one, maybe two or three sesshins. And then I became aware of how much I was distancing or separating myself from direct experience with thoughts. What is it that separates? What does separation really mean? It means thoughts, or pursuing thoughts, grasping at thoughts, involving oneself with thoughts. That's separation. It's separation from the real experience, the direct experience. She continues, "My strongest experience of wholeheartedness and commitment in personal relations is as a parent. My children are almost grown up now, and the unhesitating commitment their presence has called forth from me, from the very bottom of my heart, has surely been one of the liberating experiences of my life. It's easier for me to be wholehearted when there's no choice, no exit. Well, that's the primary reason that we don't allow people to leave Sesshin when they're having some difficulty. Because when there is no exit, then you discover your capacity for wholeheartedness. And there's no more valuable discovery than that. Because it is really the secret of life. Non-separation. We all have that capacity. It's only because of habit, mental habit, that we don't draw from that great capacity for oneness. But when there is no way out, we find it. She continues, as for Buddhist practice, I think you can't just decide to be wholehearted about that either. But what you can do is put yourself into certain situations which foster wholeheartedness, which force you to burn yourself up, leaving nothing behind. Well, obviously, Sesshin, but also staff. Staff, if it's kind of a residential staff, is kind of a diluted Sesshin experience, where you are pretty miserable if you allow yourself to be anything but fairly wholehearted. She continues, after saying certain situations which force you to burn yourself up, leaving nothing behind. And then she says, beating the drum for chanting, for example. Sitting in Zazen, it's so easy for me to lose my concentration, to sleep, to daydream, to plan. But when I'm hitting the Mokugyo, I can't think about what I'll cook for dinner. I am completely wholehearted, beating the drum and chanting the Prajnaparamita, and the drum itself seems to be my heart. I am no more beating the drum than I am beating my heart. I used to do rock climbing, and the wonderful thing about it, too, was the wholeheartedness which it required. Definitely no daydreaming as I clung by my fingernails to a pimple of granite in the sky, but rather a quite enthusiastic feeling of commitment to staying alive. The challenge, of course, is to be wholehearted about our humdrum everyday lives lived at sea level. And every moment that my whole heart is beating within me is another opportunity to be wholehearted, or to recognize that I already am wholehearted. This is the great appeal of very demanding sports and activities like rock climbing and sky jumping and sports, music, many things like this. They demand so much concentration that we have to be wholehearted, and that wholeheartedness is itself rewarding. The difference is between all of any of those activities and Zazen is that with those activities there is a dependency on those activities to get into the zone, to feel that elan, that sense of well-being that comes from complete absorption. In other words, those are like different kinds of samadhi. There's tennis samadhi, there's rock climbing samadhi, there's music playing samadhi. But in what we're doing in Zazen is training ourselves to be able to be wholehearted in whatever activity we're doing. And it does work. It doesn't transform us overnight. We have spent so long misusing our minds that it takes a lot of work sustained over months and years to be able to apply our zazen to the most ordinary, what many people would consider boring, experiences or activities of our lives. But it does happen, and we can get a little taste of it in Sesshin. She says, I have studied hand bookbinding, and in bookbinding, the word commit is used when you are pasting two surfaces together. Let's say you are making the book cover. You have your book cloth all measured and cut. You have your cardboard all measured and cut. You brush the paste on the cloth. You brush the paste on the cardboard. Then you pick up the limp cloth and hold it exactly over the cardboard, which will become your book cover. And when you're ready, you commit it. That is, you lay it down in one smooth, unhesitating movement. If you stop in the middle and wonder what you're doing, it will stretch or wrinkle or buckle or warp. So you just jump in and go for it with your whole heart. The worst that can happen is that you may have to do it over. But if you waver and are tentative, you will surely have to do it over. This is a wonderful analogy. Let's bring it back to Sesshin. If in our Sesshin practice, our Zazen, we are wavering, uncertain, acting out of a divided mind, then it can't get the best out of us. We can't get the most out of the Sesshin. It's impossible. By throwing ourselves totally into every hour, every minute of the Sesshin, which means not separating ourselves with our thoughts, then, yeah, we may get tired all of a sudden, we may have this or that happen to us, but wonderful things can happen. But no one, and I think it is safe to say, no one is wholehearted from the outset. We learn how to be wholehearted. Or rather, to put it more precisely, we unlearn the mental and physical patterns that get in the way of our innate capacity for wholeheartedness. Think of children. Children don't have to be told. They don't have to be taught how to be wholehearted. That is our nature. So it's not acquiring anything or learning anything that we have to do. It's just emptying the mind of all of the mental obstructions that get in the way of that fundamental oneness that really is our nature. She goes on, so the important thing is to be wholehearted at the moment that you are doing something. The idea that you are committing yourself to something that stretches way ahead of you into the future is perhaps not so helpful. It's true. As long as we are sitting and thinking about continuing our practice into the future lifetimes, well, that's not really the point. It's just another thought. Rather, that kind of commitment can inform our basic aspiration, and then we let go of it as a thought. She says, or maybe we focus too much on that aspect of commitment, the part that goes on over time. Two people can commit themselves to each other very sincerely, with the idea that it is for a long time, even forever. Or a person can commit herself wholeheartedly to a new job. And in the moment these commitments are made, they are made wholeheartedly. Then things change. Unforeseen circumstances arise. The people change. The couple separates. The person leaves the job. Does that mean the commitments were in any way false? What counts is making the commitment now, without covering over the wholeheartedness with too many layers of ideas. Commitment has been an issue for me in terms of my work as well. I have worked at a number of things in my life, in the fields of publishing, education, and political activism. I have suffered a great deal from my own uncertainty and changing focus. I've always wanted to write. I've always dibbed and dabbed at it, but I never, at the deepest level, committed myself to it because I was afraid. Nobody was asking me to write. The world wasn't crying out for my material. It wasn't going to save anybody from starvation. I would have to do it all alone and then persuade people to read it. My self-doubt kept getting worse and worse. And then one day, a couple of years ago, I couldn't stand it any longer. I just knew I had to commit myself to writing anyway, to put myself on a schedule, to do my work no matter what, to be completely and utterly wholehearted about it. 3 hours a day, every day, just do it, like beating the drum. Don't do the other things first, the things that people want from me, the folding of laundry, the shopping, the cooking, the driving, the meetings, the political work. Do them after. But every day, first, the writing. Well, every day, first the sitting, is what I have found to be the most perfect for me. But when you do begin the day with sitting, not start doing other things first, but really begin with sitting, then it enhances the rest of your day, or at least your morning. It does tend to fade as the day goes on and we get battered with all of the busyness of our lives. But what a difference it makes to sit first thing in the morning. She says, I feel like a new person. And the funny thing is, I'm not doing anything dramatically different from what I was doing before, but my attitude has completely changed. I've surrendered to wholeheartedness. Now the task is to focus on one project at a time and do that with full attention until it's completed. Then it's time to do the next thing. One thing has a way of leading to another. If you keep walking along a path, you get somewhere. You can always change your course as you go along, depending on the weather conditions, an unexpected rock slide, a beautiful lake that wasn't on the map. I have made a leap of faith that if I follow my heart, the other things will fall into place. So faith is connected to commitment and wholeheartedness. Faith tides you over when wholeheartedness flags. The days when I sit at my desk and I can't think of anything to say, or I don't like what I can think of, I have faith that it's going to be all right, that I'm doing what I need to be doing. Well, of course it's the same with Zen practice. There will always be dry periods in our practice. Periods when we feel that we're doing everything we can. We're making the very strongest effort we can, but it's just not working. And that's where the faith carries us along, to stick with it. And if we do stick with it, we find that it changes, and that experience of seeing it change is what nourishes our faith. And then when we reach a critical point in that building up of momentum of faith and wholeheartedness and faith and wholeheartedness, then we pull free of the Earth's gravity, so to speak. Then we're really in orbit. And then we never quit, no matter how hard it gets, because we know it will change. Final paragraph from her. Buddhist practice has helped me to make this commitment. It has helped me with what looks like self-discipline, but which, oddly, is really the kind of faith I was just talking about. It's what keeps you from getting up and leaving the zendo in the middle of the sesshin, even though your knees hurt, or you're bored, or sleepy, or claustrophobic. It's what keeps you from leaving your desk to do the laundry, even though you can't think of anything to say. I suppose it's what keeps you from leaving your husband, even though you just had a fight about whose turn it is to drive the carpool. And Buddhist practice has helped me to be wholehearted about being me, from one moment to the next. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.